Well, thank you for that lovely introduction. We're about to turn it over to Corey Flintoff, who you will now soon discover is more than a pretty voice. He's got a fascinating life. We want to get to Russia and Putin and Trump, as we've advertised. But first, we thought it would be fun to hear a little bit about his backstory. He had to know how to sign off in Alaska in two different languages, so you'll hear a variation of a sign-off in just a second. But first, to walk us through the pre-story of Corey's experiences abroad, we're going to turn to Jonathan to just see the pre-engineering of a reporter.
Yes, and we do have a lot of students in the audience, both undergrad and graduate, and we're very curious about your coming-of-age story, you know, high school, college, when you were 20 to 25 and you were plotting the next move. How did it start for you, and how did you get to the point where you became an investigative foreign correspondent?
Well, after I left the University of Chicago, where Melinda and I became friends, I decided that what I really wanted to be was a fiction writer. And that's because I took a class about Flannery O'Connor and was absolutely seduced by good short story writing. But you always are looking for that perfect place where you're gonna sit down and you're gonna write whatever your great American fiction may be. And it happened that my wife at the time was a dental student and had run up her student loans and needed to pay them off, and she did that by joining the Indian Health Service. And so that was an opportunity for me to go back to my home state of Alaska. And we wound up in a small town in southwestern Alaska on the Kuskokwim River. It's called Bethel. At that time, it had a population of around 4,000, and 90% of those people were Yupiks. They were Yupik Eskimos. And we first got there to the Public Health Service Hospital, and I asked one of the doctors there, well, what do you do for jobs around here? Where do you go? Because I thought, you know, I could support myself during the long nights while writing whatever this great American novel was going to be. And he said, oh, go to the radio station. They always need something. So turned out, sure enough, they did. And the only thing you had to do at the station, which was bilingual, was to be able to say the station identification in Yupik. So I got somebody to coach me and walk me through this until I was able to say this. Ni chugni uchi ni chugni sutkun kyuk makman ni mam talehami. And I got the job. And as I was telling somebody just earlier, that, you know, one of the things that job taught me was respect for your listeners and readers. And respect for the culture of people who surround you. I made a lot of really awful mistakes when I was a young reporter in Bethel. One of my first jobs was to cover the local city council and the school board. And when I first went there, you know, it was full of interesting characters, and they were just, you know, loud and boisterous and argumentative and fractious. And I came home and I said, these people are buffoons. You know, what am I doing spending my time covering their politics? But it didn't take very long to realize that, you know, these are the people who were on the city council and the school board were the people who made things happen in this community. And they did it out of, you know, genuine allegiance to the better interests of their community as they saw it. And I came to have a lot of respect for them. And that actually is what got me hooked on journalism as opposed to fiction.
And how did you make it to NPR Central? Everyone knows that you're the voice of the 6 o'clock news.
Yeah, well,
how'd you get there?
As Dan Rather would tell you, you know, every reporter who gets a bump up in their career usually has it because of some disaster or catastrophe. In my case, it was the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989. That was, you know, the biggest oil spill disaster that had ever happened in the United States. It was absolutely devastating to the ecology of this very pristine part of Alaska. And NPR, among other organizations, spent an enormous amount of time covering it. So that was my opportunity to do coverage for NPR and meet NPR people. And it resulted in my getting a residency at NPR. And so I got to Washington and I did the job and I thought, I could do this. You'll find students, you'll find this often. Now, these things that look rather imposing are often things when you get there, you find that the opportunities are good and, you know, the things are usually within your capacity.
Corey, take us just for a second inside the booth. We've all heard the thing. It's NPR from Washington, Corey Flinto, but what's going on? How do you get the news? How do you read it? What's the trick of doing this?
You know, there's a little factory that in the heart of every news organization, and the factory at NPR is the newscast unit. And it's a matter of a desk that's constantly staffed by four or five people who are gathering news, recording news, putting things together. The newscasters actually write their newscasts. But usually it's based on consultations with your editors. You know, you're constantly talking about what's coming up, what should you cover, what should you drop. We have reports from our various correspondents around the country and around the world, and those are coming in as pre-recorded pieces that you work into your newscast. So this whole thing comes together, and you work in a sort of cyclical world where you do a 5-minute newscast, and then you go back and you write for 45 minutes, you know, and then you go and do the same thing over and over again. The reason I have such great name recognition is because for 17 years I had the opportunity to say my name 12 times a night.
And so somehow you went from Central, NPR Central, to a rock with many steps, but there was one, I take it, a helicopter ride that really brought you to the international scene with Condoleezza Rice.
Yes, I was substituting for a really wonderful correspondent on our foreign desk, Michelle Kelman, who's still there, and she's our State Department reporter. And while she was on maternity leave, I got to substitute for her. And one of the things that came up was a round-the-world trip with Condoleezza Rice. You know, they do these periodically, and you hear reports from these trips. It's really difficult and energy-consuming because you spend your entire time either on the plane or in these various locations trying to put together a story at the last minute. And so we went to, you know, as often happens on these trips, there was an unannounced trip to Iraq. And so we landed in Bahrain, and none of this was on the schedule because they don't like to be public about these trips until they've actually taken place. And so away we went. We got onto one of these C-130s and we flew to Mosul. And as we were flying across Iraq, it's one of these big cargo planes, you know, and they have a little flight deck up above, and Condoleezza Rice was alone on the flight deck just with the pilots and the crew. And so I went up there and we sat down and we had this sort of awkward little conversation. And Condoleezza Rice looks out at the view that we're seeing, which is the Iraqi desert, just stretching for miles away. And a lot of it you couldn't see at all because there's always dust storms and there's always haze out there. She looks out and she says, "Isn't Iraq beautiful? I've been coming here for, four or five times now, and I feel I really am getting to know this country, and I really have come to love it." And I thought, oh, that's pretty admirable. Wow. So, you know, we went on and we made chit-chat and this and that, and we landed in Mosul, and we found ourselves in a completely fortified American camp, surrounded by blast walls and tanks pointing outward. And then we went from there by helicopter to Baghdad, where we landed in a completely fortified American airbase in Baghdad. And once again, we got into Humvees, you know, completely armored Humvees. We're wearing our correspondents always look ridiculous in these things because I was wearing a jacket and a tie, and I've got the bulletproof vest on, so I look like a penguin. And I've got the helmet that never quite fits right. Never looks like looks good like it does on the soldiers, you know. And so we're marching into this place under, you know, and I realized that this trip, which lasted for something like 10 hours, was what Condoleezza Rice meant when she said, well, I've been to Iraq 5 times and I feel I know it very well. She was completely shielded throughout these trips by American weaponry. And she met only people like generals and senior Iraqi politicians. So that was her idea of knowing and loving this country. I discovered afterwards that there's a lot more to it than that.
One of the things you did was embed with American troops. Tell us a little about that. That was a very different.
Yeah, the thing about it, embedding with American troops, that I learned, you know, NPR always had a household that was outside the green zone. I mean, we were well protected and we had good security, but we were never part of the green zone. So we did have a better access to Iraq. You know, we could go out in our cars and actually interview people, actually see the signs of sites of these bombings and that sort of thing. But periodically, we would also embed with the American military. And I discovered that there's a tremendous difference between riding around in NPR's armored car and riding around in a Humvee that's guarded by a Humvee crew of infantrymen. There's something about looking out the window of an armored vehicle that has a gunner on the roof that makes you instantly suspicious. I felt much less secure when I was traveling with American soldiers because the odds of being blown up were much greater. And I realized that, you know, to an American soldier looking through that bulletproof glass window, if you see, for instance, an Iraqi guy standing on the street corner talking on his cell phone, you're instantly afraid that he's either going to use that cell phone to detonate something or that he's calling in somebody else who's going to ambush you. You know, it's a very strange change that happens in your perception when you're in a situation like that. And so I understand why American troops are nervous and sometimes trigger happy in those situations. And it was the source of some of us, our biggest disasters in Iraq, the simple fact that you always feel that you're surrounded by enemy.
Many more fascinating experiences, but let's turn to the Russian.
Weren't we gonna go to?
Mm-hmm. Oh, go ahead.
Okay, all right. So I know you spent 4 years in Russia, beginning in early 2012, arriving there when there were some of the largest demonstrations we've seen during the Putin period. So I just want to ask you a few questions about your experience there. So we should start with recent events. So we know in the last week there were first of all been again large protests against corruption, then followed a few days later by this horrible bombing in St. Petersburg. I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you see as the significance of those events, in particular why you think protests have developed now after such a long period of quiescence.
It's funny, those protests were the bookends of my experience in Russia. When I first got there, it was in 2012, when there were a series of enormous protests in Moscow and St. Petersburg especially, you know, that brought tens of thousands of people into the street. And those protests were precipitated by a feeling that the parliamentary elections that preceding fall had been blatantly stolen. Mm-hmm. And in fact, everything that you'll read about those protests, you'll see that United Russia officials, and United Russia is the party of President Putin, were absolutely scandalous in the way that they stole votes in that election. Mm-hmm. People were very much aware of it, and they were really angry about it. Secondly, there was the decision by then Prime Minister Putin and then President Dmitry Medvedev to change places. Mm-hmm. You know, so it became perfectly clear to everyone that Medvedev had been doing nothing but warming Putin's seat for him for 4 years, and that this was a plan that had always been put in place to get around the Russian term limits laws. So people were really angry, and they came out in these, you know, and it was interesting to see because these people were not radicals and they were not rabble. They were absolutely middle-class people, you know, who who remember very well the Soviet Union and consider themselves to be much better off under the current regime than they were in the past. But they were people who were so angered by the by what they saw as the betrayals that were taking place that they went out on the street. Well, as soon as Putin was inaugurated, he began a campaign of extreme repression to silence opposition groups, shut down opposition media sources, and in general make it really impossible to effectively protest against his regime. So for 4 years, we'd go and cover these very small demonstrations of, you know, a group of remaining loyalists who would get out there with their signs periodically, most of them older people. We saw fewer and fewer young people who were engaged by this. And it looked, at the time we were getting ready to leave, it looked as if the Kremlin had succeeded in completely repressing any kind of opposition, opposition feelings. Some friends of mine there who told me that, you know, a friend of mine had just gone to a commemorative march in honor of Boris Nemtsov. Mm-hmm. He'd been killed almost exactly 2 years before. 5 or 10,000 people came out. They marched up and down. She said to me, "I feel like I've seen all these faces before. They're the same old people who come out every time, and there are fewer and fewer young people engaged in this." Well, so 2 weeks ago, there's all of a sudden there are huge protests in downtown Moscow and more than 100 other cities. And those protests, if you look at the video from them, they are overwhelmingly made up of young people, mm-hmm. you know, older teenagers and young adults, you know, who are being very peaceful but very passionate in this demonstration. And what got them going, once again, was a demonstration of corruption. Alexei Navalny, who is probably the most prominent remaining Russian opposition leader, mm-hmm. he's an extreme nationalist, actually, but he is also a very charismatic and witty guy. And you can go on YouTube and see his most recent little documentary about Russian corruption. It's called Don't Call Him Demon. That's one of the nicknames for Dmitry Medvedev. It is a funny takedown of Medvedev's history of collecting assembling enormous wealth, including yachts and estates and palatial mansions around the country. And it's based on, the funny part of it is, it's based on his investigation was based on Medvedev's fancy sneakers. Medvedev has a reputation for being fascinated with technology, and he loves the net, and he loves to buy stuff on the net. And so Navalny traced how, you see a photograph of Medvedev wearing a nice sweater and a pair of really colorful sneakers. You know that he probably ordered them on the internet. And so he found an invoice that showed that these sneakers had been delivered to a friend of, a lifelong friend of Medvedev's, and then he found photographs that showed Medvedev wearing these garments, you know, very shortly after that. And from that, he then proceeded to network through the friend and the friend's business connections and the shell companies that the friend owns in Cyprus and in Bermuda and in London and so forth, and associated all those companies with various properties that Medvedev has been photographed at that are thought to be his properties. So it's totally worth watching, and it has English subtitles as well. So it's only about 10 or 11 minutes. So this was something that became an instant internet hit and got millions of hits. And it's thought that that's what finally drove people into the streets in absolute frustration, because the Russian economy is not doing well. Pensioners are, and people on fixed incomes are in terrible shape. Russian infrastructure is crumbling. And here we are, this guy is wearing his fancy sneakers on the deck of his fancy yacht, you know, and we're supposed to swallow this? So I think that's what precipitated the protests. So we go on to the bombing in St. Petersburg, And as you know, Russia is no stranger to these kinds of attacks. You know, we've had terrorists open up with gunfire in the airport in Moscow. We've had people attack the metros in Moscow and other places. So my feeling is that this could have been anything. It seems that this might have been a lone wolf, Al-Qaeda-influenced kind of attack by a guy from Central Asia, mm-hmm. Kyrgyzstan, who may have been disaffected in some way. We don't know. But when you become a Russia watcher, there are three possibilities that open up to you when something like this happens. A, this is a random act committed by a random terrorist, such as we have in the United States. But the Russian government is going to seize hold of this as an opportunity and use it as a chance to enact further repression against, especially against the kind of people who took part in these protests just the week before. The second, which is the conspiracy theory, is that the Russian government itself actually committed this act as a provocation, which could then be used as a device and an excuse for more repression. You know, and the third is that that this is something that is actually an Al-Qaeda or Taliban-connected act that was actually run from abroad. So, you know, the discouraging thing for a journalist is that it's very hard to figure out what's what.
Okay, so we were talking earlier, and you talked about loving Moscow, the beautiful public parks being renovated, the society, but at the same time viewing the regime as a very corrupt kind of mafia regime. And I think many other people have had that reaction, that this is a well-educated society of wonderful people that are really badly governed. So could you just talk a little bit about that duality, that contradiction?
Yes, throughout Vladimir Putin's tenure, you know, which began in 2000, so he's been in office for 17 years, Russia enjoyed, you know, tremendous good fortune. Oil prices were high. Russia is almost entirely a resource extractive economy. Putin's fault probably is that his government has never tried to diversify that economy and protect it, mm-hmm. so that when oil prices collapsed, suddenly Russia's revenues had fallen by approximately 50%. The Russian government, incidentally, can still make money when oil goes down to as low as $30 a barrel.
Not much.
But it wreaks hell with the Russian budget. And so that's the situation that they're in now. And they had further difficulty as a result of the US and European sanctions that were brought after the seizure of Crimea. I think that those sanctions were not as serious a part of Russia's difficulties as the drop in oil prices. So overall revenue collapse was what hit them the hardest. But in the meantime, though, up until this happened, Putin and his regime were able to show great results for the Russian economy. If you go to Moscow, it is in almost every respect, at least in central Moscow, it is a modern, almost European city. If you go to St. Petersburg, it is a European city. And, you know, you find nice cafes, nice lively theaters and an interesting art scene and beautiful public parks. And it's borne out by economic statistics, too. I mean, people's wealth grew during that time. People's incomes grew, people's spending power grew. And so Russians, by and large, were pretty satisfied. And the trade-off was that, yes, this is a mafia state in many ways. Yes, most of the wealth is siphoned off by Russian oligarchs and members of the security services. But, in fact, the share that was given to the ordinary Russian consumer was so much better than what they had under Soviet times that it felt like progress. And I think that that's why Russians are still very loyal to this government, even though they know pretty much what's going on.
Okay, so I think that most of the people in the audience, most of the people in the United States who follow the news, one of their dominant understandings or impressions of Russian behavior over the last several years is that it's become quite aggressive. First there was the invasion of Georgia, then of Ukraine, the taking of Crimea, the intervention in Syria, the menacing of the Baltic states. And I just wanted to, and the Soviet, the Russian government would say that much of this behavior is actually defensive, that NATO was surrounding them, that they were determined to set limits on NATO's expansion. Others would see this as really an aggressive behavior that's designed to simply strengthen the Russian state and project power. I just wonder if you could talk about how you see the motives of the Russian government in this foreign policy.
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, I think that Putin genuinely believes that he is under threat, and he believes that the United States is the source of that threat. Mm-hmm. And he sees, you know, and he has said repeatedly that the West has continually tried to undermine Russia ever since the fall of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. You know, he's also the guy who said that the fall of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the last century.
Yes, he did.
You know, what happened to World War II? You know, but you know, so I think these are articles of faith for him. Remember that he is a lieutenant colonel in the KGB, and that most of his education came through the KGB, and he does tend to see the United States as an enemy. What's more, you know, he saw the expansion of NATO right up to Russia's borders as something that was deliberately designed to hem in Russia. I believe that his, you know, I mean, look at the Baltic states that share direct borders with Russia. They could not wait to become part of NATO because they were always afraid of Russian aggression. The same was true of Ukraine. Ukraine would have liked to have joined NATO. Georgia would have liked to have joined NATO. You can make a case for the fact that Russian aggression against places like Georgia was designed to make it impossible for them to join NATO, because NATO can't accept a member that's involved in a current conflict or war. You know, so once Georgia had been engaged, then there was no way that they could be accepted as members of NATO. Same is true of Ukraine. So, you know, there are lots of arguments on either side, but, you know, if you live in Moscow long enough, it's a bit like looking through the window of that Humvee. Everybody outside of it looks like an enemy to you. And everything that's done is not a friendly gesture anymore, but part of a conspiracy against you. You know, so they, you know, remember that they saw, I believe truly that he sees Hillary Clinton as a potential enormous enemy, and as the person who helped to foment those opposition demonstrations back in 2011, 2012. He sees, you know, the fact that the United States has indeed spent a great deal of money in Russia and Eastern Europe for democracy building programs, for election monitoring programs, for independent press. He sees that as subversion, you know, absolute naked subversion, very much as we see the accusation that Russia has hacked American elections. You know, so it's a question of which side of that armored window you're on.
Okay, and one final question. So you raised already the issue of Hillary Clinton, but I still wonder whether the Russian government or most of the Russian political and security elite would really want it to hurt Clinton, that they really preferred Trump, a complete unknown, somebody whose foreign policy they knew nothing, whose behavior was unpredictable. Do you think that the Russian government was really determined to damage the electoral prospects of Hillary Clinton?
They certainly despised Hillary. Now, whether that meant that they could work with her was another thing. I talked to analysts in Moscow who said, yeah, we know what she's all about, and although we may not be able to work with her, we can do deals. We can work on nuclear proliferation, which is important to both sides. You know, we can work on maintaining a degree of military cooperation so we don't collide with each other and inadvertently start a war. You know, there are many reasons for us to want to keep engaging Russia. And they thought, well, at least Hillary they know what kind of diplomacy she does, and they've dealt with her a lot. So there was a certain amount of stability in that. On the other hand, you know, people told me that there are two potential wins for Russia if Donald Trump were elected. You know, one is that he may in fact be friendly enough towards Russia, and he may in fact not care enough about the foreign policy implications of Ukraine, for instance, that he may be willing to drop sanctions. And if the United States dropped sanctions, Russia would soon follow after. And that would be a tremendous win for the Kremlin. The second would be that if Donald Trump created an atmosphere of chaos and turmoil in the United States, it would take away American attention from foreign policy altogether, and thus give Russia a much, much freer hand to operate geopolitically. So there are two potential wins.
Okay,
on the other hand, they did understand that the unpredictability could come back to bite them in the backside.
And one might say bite us as well.
Yes.
We're about to turn to Corey's future, but as soon as we do, we'll open it up to questions. So there are two microphones. So please, if you want to ask a question, open it up to you all. Anything goes, please just head for a microphone. But before we do that, let's talk about the future.
Yeah, and obviously there's much more to discuss about Putin, Trump, and Russia, and we're hoping that questions will, you know, follow suit about that. But we are curious, you seem to be making a move after a very illustrious career to going back to fiction writing, the
yes.
initial youthful aspiration. Can you talk more about what's next?
Yes, I am. I have a novel on the boards. You know, what I want to do is take my experience as a foreign correspondent and apply it to fiction. You know, I mean, there's so much that you have to be careful about when you're talking about things that you've reported in the past. Mm-hmm. And I would like to simply apply the things I learned in Iraq, for instance, about what militaries are like and what happens when military adventures go wrong. Or the things that I learned in India, for instance, about what happens when economies collapse or rise or fall, you know, and what happens when cultures are disrupted and that sort of thing. And so why not do it as fiction, where you can combine all these things into a single narrative, you know? So that's what's up for me. And you know, the other thing is I still like talking about Russian foreign policy, so I'll keep doing that.
All right.